Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone. This is Beverly Tomasian, and I'd like to welcome you to the third in our mini series. And it's been a real pleasure teaching these classes and reaching out to all of you across the country, sharing information about diabetes care. And the great thing is we don't have to travel. We're just here together virtually. So thank you for joining us and taking time out of your day. I really, really appreciate it. Our third class, we have a lot of objectives to cover, so I'm just going to move ahead, and that is looking at insulin therapy. So we're going to look at insulin therapy in the home setting, in the hospital setting, and we're going to look at glucose patterns and adjustment strategies. We'll look at national guidelines too, and how do we incorporate those national guidelines into our practice. So glucose management in hospitalized patients. You know, when I first started in diabetes education, I worked at Stanford Hospital in the 90s, the late 90s, and there was really no data to support that inpatient glucose management made a difference. So patients were running pretty high blood sugars. On average, our patients were running blood sugars of 200 and greater. And so we did a study and we evaluated, you know, before we implemented this new strategy. And the new strategy was a standardized insulin sliding scale. This was about 20 years ago. And by doing the standardized scale, we actually improved glycemic control. And so each one of us out there, if you work in the hospital setting, can be real advocates for improving inpatient diabetes care. And maybe you don't have a big team, maybe you don't have a dedicated endocrinologist. It's okay. Just start with what you have and build your program, because just by raising awareness and saying this is important, momentum is created. And for those of you who work in the outpatient setting, our patients, as you know, get sick and get admitted to hospitals. So this is helpful for you because then you can help them get ready and prepared for an inpatient visit, which will happen during their lifetime, it's certain, and help them to advocate for the best care possible. So before we get started, as always, you know, I like doing polls, and I want to select our first poll and ask you all this question. What percent of hospitalized patients do you think have diabetes? Just take a guess. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate it. Let's take a few more seconds to vote. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share it with you. There was a new study that just came out, and it was out of UCLA that said about 30% of hospitalized patients have diabetes. So many of you chose 50%, and I'm going to take a guess why you chose 50. You work on a cardiac unit or vascular unit, or maybe you work on a medical unit where it seems like everybody has diabetes. So that's certainly true in certain units, especially any unit or hospital unit dealing with vascular disease, a lot of your patients will have diabetes. That is certain. We know the number one expenditure for people with diabetes is hospital care. And so, you know, hospital care for diabetes is costly because our patients usually enter the hospital more sick and stay longer. But it's about 30% right now, 1 in 3. So we're going to see a lot of patients in the hospital with diabetes. Let me ask you another question. Last time we talked about glucose goals for outpatient. What do you think are the glucose goals for patients in the hospital? So what are we trying to get that blood sugar? What is our target for the inpatient setting? And if you don't work in the inpatient, you may not know this, but take a guess because it's pretty close to the outpatient goal. And I think this is helpful to know, even if you work on outpatient side, when your patient goes into the hospital, you want to let them know these are the national goals. This is what you need to work with your team to get your blood sugars to in the hospital setting. It's going to improve outcomes and help you feel better and have less risk of infection. Okay, thanks everyone for voting. You did excellent. You're right. 83% of you chose the correct answer, less than 140 pre-meal and less than 180 post-meal. So for the outpatient side, it's a little different. It's less than 130 pre-meal, 70 to 130 pre-meal, and less than 180 post-meal, but almost exactly the same. Okay, one more question and we'll launch in to our topic a little bit more, but according to the American Diabetes Association, what is the best strategy to manage glucose for patients in the hospital setting? And this was just published in 2014 standards. The ADA made a bold statement to say how we should manage inpatient blood sugars. And usually the American Diabetes Association is pretty conservative. So when they make bold statements, people listen. Well, I listen. And but it gives us as educators and advocates ammunition. So look at the American Diabetes Association is saying this. Let's make it happen. Okay, I'm going to close this and share with you. So we had a close race here. 58% of you said basal bolus insulin therapy and 42% of you said sliding scale. I'm not going to release the answer quite yet. What I'd like to do is go through the topic and then we'll come to the answer naturally. So let's just talk about this and about hospitals and hyperglycemia. What is the big deal? And many times, you know, providers have said to me in the past, not so much anymore, like, Beverly, why are you so upset about this hyperglycemia? They're in the hospital. They're sick. They're infected. They've had a heart attack. Of course, their blood sugars are going to be elevated. And what I can say back, and I'm going to give you language to talk to them, to providers and people who are resistant to getting blood sugars to go, is that hyperglycemia in the hospital setting is associated with worse outcomes, not only inpatient, but also outpatient. And there is more increased death associated with hyperglycemia in the hospital setting. So you can see here, there's more infection, longer length of stay. If people have surgery, that's more likely to get infected. They're more likely to have clots. Let's get those blood sugars down in the hospital setting. And the other thing I think about a lot is if all of us smart people are letting patients run high in the hospital, what message does that send the patient? It says to them, hey, you know, in the hospital, there's all these, you know, doctors and providers and nurses and dietitians and pharmacists. They let me, my blood sugar run 250. Why should I bother? We want to give a clear message to patients that excellent blood sugar control matters, inpatient or outpatient. Here's a great study looking at medical surgical patients in a community hospital. And this is Dr. Umpiedas, and he, if you just Google his name, there's a ton of articles associated with him as far as inpatient management of diabetes. And he did a most excellent study. What he did is patients entered his hospital, he had them check the blood sugars. And what he found just by every patient who entered the hospital was for about 9 months, I believe. And so by just using blood sugar criteria, listed here below, fasting 126 or greater, if it was a random 200 or greater, that 26% of patients walking through the door had diabetes, 26%. That was diagnosed. But here's a really perplexing thing, and the thing that really, it's not perplexing as much, is shocking and noteworthy, is that 12% reached the criteria for diabetes but were not diagnosed. So that means that we might have 30% of patients in the hospital with known diabetes, but maybe 12% who have diabetes and don't know it. And if you look at the outcome data, this looks at normal glycemia throughout the hospital setting, and this is looking at mortality, death. If they have known diabetes, here's their risk of death. But look at this. If they have new hyperglycemia and it's not managed, the risk of death is much higher. So, and even in the ICU, that result is even more profound. Here's what I'm trying to say is that hyperglycemia reflects a stress state in the body. So if I have diabetes and I walk into a hospital, they're going to manage my diabetes and get my glucose to go. If I have new hyperglycemia, it may not be A, detected, and B, managed, because I don't carry the official diagnosis of diabetes. But we need to pay attention to those people because their blood sugars are high because they're in a stress state. They're in they're having a lot of inflammation, vascular changes, hyperglycemia, probably some hypertension. Hyperglycemia is a warning signal of a body out of balance. It warrants our attention. So, as we are diabetes detectives, we're going to look for patients in the hospital with hyperglycemia. And if their fasting labs come back 100 to 125, that's pre-diabetes. And we're going to have a conversation with that patient and say, look, your blood sugars are running above target range of 100, because fasting blood sugar should be less than 100. It looks like, according to the numbers that we have in the hospital, you're in the pre-diabetes range. And I would give them that information, give them handouts on pre-diabetes and how to prevent it from going on to diabetes, and have them follow up with their provider. This is so important. So some people may say to me, well, Bev, you're in the hospital, you're stressed. No wonder your pancreas isn't working. But listen to this. The guy in the bed right next to you, he is in stress. He's infected. He's had a heart attack. His blood sugars are normal. Why is that? It's because his pancreas is working. His pancreas is working great, and he can handle the stress. But the person in the next bed whose numbers are high because they're infected, their pancreas doesn't have enough beta cell production to get the blood sugars to target. Hospitalization, infection, stress is a pancreatic stress test. How well does the pancreas perform under fire, under duress? Diabetes, as you know, here's a diagnostic criteria. So if we find patients in these categories, we need to inform them, get the doctors involved, get the providers involved, and provide appropriate treatment. And Dr. Umpieras and team says, any blood glucose in the hospital that we find above 140, we have to take action. And that action usually translates into insulin. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we asked you, what are the goals for glucose management for the hospital patient? And you can see if the blood glucose is more than 180 for critically ill patients, we start insulin. And here's the goal, 140 to 180. Non-critically ill patient, anybody over 140, we're going to get them on insulin management with a goal of less than 140 before meals, less than 180. After meals. And you can see here, insulin therapy is a preferred treatment. So getting back to that poll question, what does the ADA say we should do to help patients in the hospital reach target? And number one, they say stop oral agents. Wow. Stop oral agents. Look at this. Second bullet point. The sole use of sliding scale insulin is discouraged. So what they're saying is, in the hospital, let's do some thoughtful management. Let's prepare patients for discharge early on. And they do say on discharge, oral meds can be resumed. This is tricky then. A patient comes in, they have a 3-day length of stay. We stop oral agents, get them on insulin, basal bolus. Then before they walk out the door, we've got to get them back on their oral meds and make sure they have a plan for management. I'm not saying it's easy, but these are the standards we need to work toward. So basal bolus therapy, they say you can use MPH and regular. You can use, you know, a long-acting and a rapid-acting, premixed insulins. However you do it, it's okay, but try and get those blood sugars to target. So for the inpatient setting, start early, focus on survival skills. And I love this slide. This slide comes from the clinical guidelines for the management of hyperglycemia. You can see it's on the bottom here. For patients in the non-critical care setting. And this is Dr. Umpiedis and team. And this is really helpful. So in our hospital right now, we're saying anybody who walks through the door with diabetes, we want to get an A1C checked on them because we want to help get ready for discharge early on. And if the A1C on admission is less than 7, we know they have pretty good diabetes control on the outpatient side. So we can just restart their treatment regimen. But if their A1C is 7 to 9, we have to rethink the plan. The plan probably on the outpatient side wasn't working. Look what it says, restart outpatient oral agents and maybe discharge on the long-acting insulin once daily at half the hospital dose. Interesting. If the A1C was 9 or greater, which means this person, you know, his diabetes is not well controlled at all, DC on basal bolus insulin that was used in the hospital, or restart oral agents and get them on their glargine and see if they need some bolus insulin, or get them on a long-acting insulin. So I think this is a very helpful slide. Let's take a look at some common scenarios that might happen in the hospital. And so let's just say the patient was, you know, it was time to eat. The nurse passed out the trays, or somebody passed out the food trays, but the patient ate lunch before the nurse had a chance to give the insulin. What can we do then? So she comes in the room. The patient says, I already ate, he or she. So let me just talk about some different things we could say. A, we could talk to our patients and say, hey, you know what? Don't eat your food until you get your insulin. So this is a great teaching opportunity. Page me when your food comes and make sure I give you your insulin before you eat the meal. And we could explain why. If I don't give you insulin before the food, your blood sugars might run too high and then we have to chase it all day long. So the most important thing here is we want to associate insulin with meals. That's true for the outpatient side too. The other thing, you know, we could do is really say to the patient, this is important for us. Oh, wait, I wanted to say the other thing we could do, and that is give the insulin after the meal. And so you might have, if it's been more than a half an hour since you last checked the blood sugar, you might have to recheck again and give insulin based on that newer blood sugar number. But generally speaking, if it's been within a half hour, you can go ahead and give the insulin that was originally, it was dosed for. Okay, so look at this. Nurse administered insulin and patient only ate a few bites of turkey and drank a non-sugar tea. Interesting. So what if the nurse gave 5 units of insulin, fast acting, and the patient just had turkey and non-sugar tea? This is a problem because the patient hasn't eaten any carbohydrates. Patients, I always explain to people that when you take insulin, you need to eat starch so it can work together with the insulin. Because we know if this patient doesn't have any carbohydrates associated with that meal, they're at high risk of hypoglycemia. So this is a very important teaching moment to say to patients, when you take insulin, you need to associate it with carbohydrates. And I will tell them also, if you're not going to eat much carbohydrate with the meal, you might want to cut back on your insulin. That applies for type 1s or type 2s, and we may need to give them some clear guidelines around that. But if my patient's just going to have a salad for lunch, you know, and no starch or very little starch, they have to cut back on their insulin. In this situation, we're going to have to, you know, look at this patient, see what their blood sugars are, but we may need to provide them with some carbohydrate like orange juice or graham crackers or some crackers, something to interact with that fast-acting insulin. Let's look at this next situation. You just gave the patient 3 units of aspart, which is a very fast-acting insulin, and patient has to go to OR now. So that means they're going to the operating room, their MPO. What are we going to do? We're going to have to hang an IV drip that has some dextrose in it. So you can't give insulin and not associate it with some food caloric intake. This patient's MPO, let's hang a bag of D5 or D10 to help prevent hypoglycemia. And this can happen in the outpatient too. The patient may have given themselves some insulin and for some reason they can't eat, the food is delayed. What can they do? Well, they always need to associate their insulin with food to prevent hypoglycemia or have an emergency food backup in case they can't get to their usual meal. Always have food with you if you have diabetes and you're taking insulin. It's a common message we're going to repeat to our patients on insulin therapy. Let's take a look at Mrs. Jones. She's in the hospital, and she came in for a bladder infection, actually. She came in for a bladder infection, but we found out she's one of that 12% who have diabetes and don't know it, that in addition to her bladder infection, her blood sugars were elevated. Her glucose on admission was 237, and that definitely reaches the criteria for diabetes, a random blood sugar 200 or greater definitely reaches that criteria. So plus her UTI, it looks like she's got type 2 diabetes. So now she says to you, I came into the hospital to help my UTI and you guys gave me diabetes. It feels like that to a lot of our patients. How are we going to manage her diabetes in the hospital? We'll have to start her on insulin therapy in the hospital. But it's probably temporary. She'll be able to go home on oral medications because she's just kind of newly diagnosed with diabetes. We don't have an A1C, but her blood sugar is only 237 with a urinary tract infection. So we know probably we could send her home on some metformin. We're going to try it out in the hospital, see if it works. But the question we want to figure out is what supplies will she need when she goes home? Well, certainly she's going to need a glucose monitor to check her blood sugars on an ongoing basis. What else is she going to need? So she'll need lancets and strips to go along with that. Any other supplies you can think of? Will we send her home with insulin? Probably not, because we're going to send her home with oral medications. And then we need to figure out what resources and referrals can we provide with her. And so here's some five basic survival skills. What do people need to know before they go home? We may not be able to teach them everything on that checklist, but here are some critical things they need to know, and that is the basics of diabetes. What are the goals? What is too high of a blood sugar? What is too low? And can they perform self blood glucose monitoring? So we're going to help her learn how to test her blood sugar in the hospital and watch her do return demonstrations. Can she safely take her medications? Does she know when to take her medications, her metformin? Take it with meals? I mean, she's on insulin. Does she know how to inject? She's not going to go home on insulin, but if a patient does, we need to watch them inject the insulin before discharge and make sure they can do it safely. Do they know how to eat and how to associate their medication with food? Very, very important hypoglycemia prevention. So patients need to know the signs, their signs of hypo, and what to do. Follow-up plan. You know what? In the hospital setting, we may be able to do some survival skill teaching, but when you have diabetes, it's a lifetime. So we need to make sure this patient has resources on the outpatient side. If you have a diabetes education program, a dietitian, outpatient education center, home health, they need to follow up with their primary care provider. And very, very important is, who do they contact when they need help? If their blood sugars are above or below target, the patient needs to know that they need to contact their provider or someone to adjust their medications. So the bottom line is, a lot of our patients in the hospital have diabetes. About 10% are not officially diagnosed. We want to look for those patients, and we want to make sure they get the care they need. Heart disease is a leading cause of hospitalization for people with diabetes, vascular disease. So we want to look for patients in the hospital with risk factors. They're smokers, hypertension, central abdominal obesity, abnormal lipids. They're more likely to have diabetes. And when we find these patients, we want to make sure to provide them with resources and help promote self-advocacy. And that is, we want to give our patients a language that lets the provider know they're ready to help participate in taking care of their diabetes. So here's another summary of this, that hyperglycemia is a marker of the body in distress, and it deserves our attention. Glucose control improves outcomes inpatient and outpatient, and insulin is really required in the inpatient side to get blood sugars to target. I never doubt that you can make a difference. Inpatient diabetes management really is important for the patient and gives them a clear message that glucose control is important. Okay, so that's kind of a summary of the inpatient side of why insulin management is required and kind of the reasons behind it and what the goals are for inpatient glucose management. But now what I'd like to turn our attention to for the rest is insulin therapy from ants to analogs. So the reason that I have this title from ants to analogs is in the early days, they would be able to tell that somebody had diabetes because their sugar was sweet. And how did they know their sugar was sweet? Well, I didn't mean to say their sugar was sweet. Their urine was sweet. So they were spilling glucose out through their urine, and ants would be attracted to their urine because it was so sweet. So in the old days, they used to, you know, identify people who had diabetes. This was one of the methods. Or just like people would say, yes, I could tell something was wrong because the ant was attracted to the sweet urine. Now, what is an analog? Well, an analog is insulin that's made through recombinant DNA therapy. So in the old days, we used to use pigs and cows. We used to grind up their pancreases to make insulin. But nowadays, we use E. coli and yeast to make insulin. And that's what an insulin analog is. Insulin analogs are very similar to our own insulin structure and amino acid sequence. They're just off by a few. So what the researchers have done is tweak the insulin molecule, rearrange the amino acids by one or two to help make this injected insulin work more quickly or extend its duration of action. That's what an analog is. This is Banting and Best. Now, Banting and Best were working in the summer 1921 trying to discover insulin because so many children globally were getting type 1 diabetes. And in those days, in the 20s, type 1 diabetes really was a death sentence. Because when you have type 1 diabetes, you make no insulin. You can't hold on to glucose for energy. You lose it through your urine. And so Banting and Bess were working frantically to discover how to act to get insulin to make help these kids live. And what they were doing is taking pancreases out of dogs. They had these experimental dogs. They would essentially give the dogs type 1 diabetes by taking out their pancreas. They would grind up the pancreas, and then they take the solute, the fluid that they got from the ground up pancreas, try to clean it up a little bit, but re-inject the dog. And what they found out in this dog, Marjorie, is that they took out her pancreas, but they ground up the cells and got the fluid and injected insulin. Marjorie could live because they saw the blood sugar coming down. So what they said is, if you don't have a pancreas, you could actually, take the fluid the pancreas makes and inject it, and they called it insulin. And when you give insulin, life is sustained. And so here's a picture of a little boy. We saw him in the first of the series. He has type 1 diabetes, and you can see he makes no insulin, so he can't hold on to glucose for fuel. Instead, he's used his fat for fuel, and he's used muscle for fuel. He's completely depleted of his energy stores. And you can see this little boy is very dehydrated. He's probably in chronic diabetic ketoacidosis, and his chance of life is so slim. But he was born in the right year, because he was born in the year when insulin was invented. When he needed insulin the most, it was available to him. And here's some of the early insulins that were available finally in 1922. So they would go to the slaughterhouses, gather all the beef and pig pancreases, grind them up, and the University of Toronto and Eli Lilly were working hard to make enough insulin to keep up with the demand. But here's this little boy, JL, December 15th, 1922, without insulin, has a pancreas that is not producing any insulin, and here he is 2 months later. Is that amazing? The same little boy. Look at those chubby cheeks. He's no longer failure to thrive. He can now hold on to his body's energy. And so many of my patients say, "Bev, I don't want to go on insulin. Insulin's awful. You get addicted to it. It means I'm on a needle." But to me, insulin is a life-saving hormone. And it's really thanks to the work of Dr. Banting Best and his colleagues who discovered insulin and made it available worldwide. This is a great picture. It's an electromicrograph. And what you see here in yellow is the receptors, insulin receptors, and blue is insulin. So here insulin is looking for its receptor. Boom, it finds it. And when insulin binds with the receptor, it starts a whole cascade of chemical reactions inside of the cell that helps us utilize glucose. And so this is just amazing to see what's happening on the surface of the cell. As I've mentioned, a lot of our patients don't want to go on insulin because, hang on 1 second, because of the fear. So a lot of times patients say, "My provider threatened me with a needle." And what that means is that the provider said to them, "If you don't get your blood sugars under control, you're going to have to go on insulin." And so instead of having a positive relationship with the insulin, they have this negative relationship with the insulin, because many providers don't realize that insulin has a lot of benefits for patients, even with type 2 diabetes. And many patients don't really feel that insulin would help them better manage their diabetes. So if you're finding patients who say, "I don't want to go on insulin, there's no way," you want to investigate with them. Tell me why. Why don't you want to go on insulin? What are some barriers? Because a lot of times they have legitimate barriers that we need to address and help them work beyond. And the other way to help decrease barriers is use short needles. A lot of people think, well, if the patient's very obese or has a lot of subcutaneous fat, the short needles won't work. But in fact, they work just as well. There's studies out that show that even for patients who are morbidly obese, these little 4 millimeter needles can still get the insulin to where it needs to go. Insulin is a subcutaneous injection. We need to inject it into the fat. We do not want to go into the muscle. It's not designed to go into the muscle. We want to make it go into the fat so it's absorbed like a hormone would be absorbed. For our thin patients, we may need to inject at an angle. And if your patients are experiencing any leakage, you want to actually have them, after they inject, count to 10, hold the needle in there, and that will help with absorption of the insulin. And so if you're at all involved with writing discharge prescriptions or helping suggest discharge supplies, I really would recommend short needles for our patients because they have less fear of them and it does the same job. So before we go on, let's do one more poll. We're going to talk about insulin therapy. So I want to ask you this question, and that is, what best describes the responsibility of bolus insulin? So what does bolus insulin do? What's its job is the question I want to ask you. Oh, does it say it's closed? Can you all see that? Oh, I don't think so. Sorry, that isn't working. Well, I'll just go over with you and I'll just share it so we can do it together. So bolus insulin actually does help cover carbs and prevent hyperglycemia. So we use bolus insulin to help cover the carbohydrates and get down blood sugars when they are elevated. So that's what that does. Let me do another one with you. Let's see if this one will work. Okay. Elevated fasting blood glucose level indicate a need for what kind of insulin? So if the fasting blood sugars are elevated, what would be the right strategy to get those fasting blood sugars down? Okay. Thank you for voting, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and close this. So this is a really great question. If your patients are on basal bolus therapy, they're on short and long-acting insulin, if their fasting blood sugars are elevated, and 72% of you chose this, so great job, they need basal insulin. Basal insulin is a long-acting insulin. Bolus insulin is fast-acting, so that really covers meals and hyperglycemia. But if their morning blood sugars are high, we need to increase usually basal insulin. Now, if you're not familiar with these terms, basal bolus, we have our insulin pocket cards that you can download, and I put that link on your resource page. You can download that, and then it separates it by basal insulin, bolus insulin, and mixed insulins. And that's a real helpful tool for you to get comfortable with these different types of insulins and when they work their hardest. Okay, thanks everyone. Let's see, let's go on to the next slide here. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit more about basal bolus insulins and what their job is. So here's mealtime glucose. So every time I eat food, my blood sugar spikes. What does my pancreas do in response? Look what it does. It releases bolus insulin. So bolus insulin is that fast squirt from my pancreas that helps lower my blood sugars and keep them under control at meals. You can see this patient's blood sugar, or this person's, never goes higher than 140 because even after they eat, because they're squirting out enough insulin to cover the meals. Now, for our patients, how do we imitate that? Well, we give them bolus insulins to cover meals. And the bolus insulins, if you can look at your pocket cards or if you want to just visualize this for a minute, are like regular insulin is the original bolus insulin. And we have Novolog and we have Humalog and Apidra. Those are insulins that cover food and hyperglycemia at that moment, and they imitate what the pancreas would do. Now, in between meals, this is kind of interesting when you have something called basal glucose. So glucose is being released from our liver when we don't eat. So our liver is a tremendous glucose warehouse. And when we're not eating and overnight, our liver releases sugar to maintain a steady state of basal glucose. But what you need is an insulin to keep that basal glucose under check. And the insulin we use in our body is basal insulin. What does that mean? Well, our pancreas squirts out about 0.5 units of insulin an hour. 0.5 units of insulin an hour in general. So it's just squirting out a little bit of insulin 24 hours a day to suppress the liver from over-releasing glucose. And that's when we give patients basal insulin, that's what we're trying to do. Suppress the liver from releasing glucose in between meals and through the night. So our basal insulins are our NPH, Detemir, and Glargine. Those are insulins that help in the background control blood sugar. So basal insulin, the efficacy is reflected in the fasting blood sugar. Bolus insulin, we can tell how well it's working by looking at post-meal blood sugars. So I call these my insulin action teams. The bolus insulin lowers after meal blood glucose, and it's the rabbit. So it gets in there, does its job, and hops back out. It only lasts for about 4 hours. Basal insulin is not a rabbit at all. It's actually what I would consider a turtle. It's in no rush to get and to do its job, and it hangs around for a half a day to a day, and then it slowly works its way out. Basal insulin controls between meal blood sugars and through the night. Bolus lowers after meal blood sugar levels. So we need both of these working together to get blood sugars to goal. Now, thinking about discharge, let me ask you this question. If a patient's going home, maybe they're cash pay, they don't have very good insurance, of which of these insulins is the cheapest? If we're going to send patients home on insulin, they don't have very good insurance, what would be a cost-effective insulin to send them home on? Okay, 30% of you voted. Thank you, everybody, for voting. I appreciate it. You may not know the answer. That's okay. Just take a guess. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close this since most of you have voted. Thank you so much. And I'm going to share this with you. So 70% of you chose the right answer. Regular and MPH, the old-fashioned insulins that have been around the longest, are the cheapest. And actually, patients can buy regular and MPH at Walmart for very great prices. In my community, I have a lot of patients who are cash pay, don't have very good insurance, or have a high deductible, and they're struggling just to get food on the table. And so I wanted to share this with you, that you can see Walmart has a special brand called their Relyon brand, where they sell a vial of insulin, which is a month's supply. One vial has 1,000 units of insulin on it, but you have to toss out the insulin bottle after a month. So it lasts for a month, and you have to toss it. It's $25. I just want to show you, a bottle of Humalog is an insulin analog, $200. Levemir, a basal insulin, $300. And I just called pharmacies in my area to find out what they were. So you can see, if patients have a big copay or they have to meet a deductible, these insulins can really add up. So we want to address the financial issues too. If diabetes is too expensive, patients don't do it. They give up, or they may be too embarrassed to admit, hey, I'm not taking my insulin, it costs too much. We want to help them to succeed. So I think this is a very important aspect of what we do as educators and advocates, help patients make diabetes as affordable as possible. So just to kind of, you know, reiterate key points here, bolus insulins are insulins that get in quickly. You can see within 15 minutes for the analogs, within 30 minutes for regular insulin. Their peak action is fast. So these insulins, especially this, the analogs here, you inject and then you eat. If the patient's on regular insulin, we do like them to delay eating by 15, 20, 30 minutes to give the regular insulin some time to get working. Regular insulin does take longer to get going, but it also lasts longer. So you'll get 6 hours of coverage with regular insulin versus the analogs, which maybe last 4 hours. So it's just, there's pros and cons to both, but I think for convenience, most people prefer these analogs because they get in really quickly. You can eat right away. But as far as the cost issue, it's definitely something to consider. Despite the valiant efforts of the research group, the insulin suppository still had one major problem. So why do I have this slide? Well, I have this slide because for many, many years, since 1920, we've been trying to figure out a different way to give insulin besides injections. People don't like injections. And they've tried suppositories, they've tried patches, they've tried all kinds of different things. But the thing that's looking most promising right now is inhaled insulin. I don't know if you were around when Pfizer had this inhaled device. It didn't take off. I'm not sure why. Maybe the device was too big and bulky. There was some data that was showing maybe it harmed the alveoli. And so that never took off. But Afrezza, and this is MannKind, is looking at FDA approval for their inhaled insulin again in July. They've been up in front of the FDA many times now. FDA keeps asking for more data, safety data, all kinds of data. And so maybe by mid-July, we'll get approval for a new inhaled insulin. And look at the device size, so much smaller than this original device. So hopefully we'll see some movement with that. So the bolus insulin summary is we have four different types of bolus insulins currently. They start working fast, they get out fast. How do we tell how well a bolus insulin is working? Well, we look at the post-meal blood glucose. So we can also look at the next meal blood sugar. So before next meal blood sugar, we'll talk about that in a minute, will be another way to see how effective was that bolus insulin. This is really such an important bullet point. Bolus insulin should comprise about half the daily dose. And so if your patient's on insulin, he's on fast-acting and long-acting, add up the total amount of insulin that patient takes a day. Half of it should be bolus insulin. I see a lot of patients who get way more long-acting insulin and they don't take enough short-acting and their blood sugars are still not well controlled. We'll give you a formula for that in a few slides, but just do a quick calculation. Add up total, half of it should be bolus. And generally speaking, one unit of bolus insulin covers about 10 to 15 grams of carbohydrate. So what is 15 grams of carb? Well, it's a piece of bread. It's a small piece of fruit. It's a half a glass of juice. It's a cup of milk. That's one unit covers that. So if I eat 60 grams of carb for my lunch, which is pretty common, I would need 4 units. The other thing I have listed here is one unit of insulin lowers blood glucose 30 to 50 points. It's a big range. So if I'm a lean person, I'm more insulin sensitive. The leaner I am, the more I respond to insulin, generally speaking. So for a very lean person, maybe their BMI is 24, one unit might drop their blood sugar 50 points. They're more sensitive to insulin. So one unit has bigger bang for the buck. But if I'm a heavier patient, maybe my BMI is 30, 35, one unit might drop my blood sugar only 30 points. So the heavier we are, the more insulin resistant we are. The leaner we are, the more insulin sensitive. So insulin sensitivity is very relative to body weight. And I do want to mention that some of my patients who are having an infection, they get very insulin resistant, even though they might be lean on the lean side. So an infection, steroids can make you more insulin resistant and require much more insulin than normal. It may just be a temporary rise in insulin requirements. So how do we tell if the bolus insulin is enough? Our patients bring us logbooks. So anytime your patient brings you a logbook and shows you their record, and this is so important. Even before I comment on what their blood sugars are, I will say to that patient, thank you for bringing in your logbook. Thank you for remembering to bring it, and thank you for writing down your numbers. This is really amazing, all the work you were doing. We want to acknowledge the work because their blood sugar numbers may not be where they want them to be, and they may feel discouraged. Always give them a lot of love for the work. It's so important. And so when we look at their logbooks, we're going to say things like this. Oh, I see after you eat, your blood sugars are reaching target. They're less than 180. So I'm saying it like that because I don't ever say to them, wow, your blood sugars are really high after meals because they might feel bad, like they failed. If their blood sugars are not at target after meals, I just tell them it's information to help us make adjustments to the plan. And so we really want to take the emotions out of blood sugars and remind patients you are not your blood sugars. It's just giving us information about the plan. The goal for, okay, so this patient takes the Humalog before breakfast. We could have them check their blood sugar 2 hours after breakfast, see if it's less than 180. Or we could rely on the before next meal blood sugar. So I could say, take your Humalog before breakfast and let's see what your before lunch blood sugar is. The target then would be 70 to 130. So the target is adjusted based on when they check their blood sugar. After meal target, less than 180. Before next meal, less 70 to 130. So let's just take a look at insulin sliding scale. We ask the question, how do we manage blood sugars in the hospital, and why is insulin sliding scale running out of favor? Why don't we want to use that anymore? Well, let's look at this, because I think this example really hits home why insulin sliding scale is not an effective strategy to manage diabetes. Now this insulin scale starts at 150 and we give 2 units for every 50 above 150. So that means if the patient's running 150 to 199, we give 2 units. If they're 200 to 249, we give 4 units and so forth. And so this patient comes into the hospital, or this could be outpatient, it doesn't even matter. But let's just look and see, is this sliding scale going to be effective at getting their blood sugar to target? They walk in and their blood sugar is 94, and based on that blood sugar, they require no insulin. So no insulin is given, and they eat 45 to 60 grams of carbohydrates. Well, when you eat those carbohydrates, you know that blood sugar is going to go up, and sure enough, it does. So if you don't have a functional pancreas, you eat food, it has carbohydrates, and there's no insulin associated with that food, it is 100% predictable that that blood sugar is going to go up. And sure enough, at lunch, it's 212. Now, at 212, we're going to give 4 units of insulin. So is that the right amount? Well, this is kind of interesting because this patient ate 45 grams of carbohydrate. So if you gave 1 unit for every 15 grams, that would be 3 units to cover the carbohydrate. And maybe you give 1 unit for hyperglycemia. So 4 units is about right, just by accident. So we give this patient 4 units, and now we're going to look at the next meal's blood sugar. So we know the target for before next meal is 70 to 130. The patient is running at 148, above target. Not bad, though. One of the better numbers of the day. Now, because this patient's blood sugar is less than 150, guess what? No insulin is given, because the scale says only give insulin if you're 150 or above. So what's going to happen? This patient's going to eat 60 grams of carbohydrate for dinner. Now, if I'm going to eat 60 grams and I take 1 unit of insulin for every 15 grams, how many units would I need? 4. I get 0. We already know what's going to happen at bedtime, and sure enough, it does happen. The blood sugar is 254. What is the target for bedtime? Less than 180. So this is a problem with sliding scale. It doesn't match what the patient needs. It's just a formula. It doesn't consider what their blood sugar is and what they're going to eat. It just says, based on the blood sugar, give this. And it doesn't consider that you need insulin to cover the carbohydrate intake. So now we're at a very important juncture, and that is bedtime. Bedtime is a dangerous time for people with diabetes on insulin, because if you give insulin at night, fast-acting insulin at night, you can cause severe hypoglycemia in the middle of the night. And the most common time that people get severe hypos is in the middle of the night. And so if I work with any patients who come in to see me, inpatient or outpatient, and they're taking a fast-acting insulin at bedtime, I stop that. Because if they're running high at bedtime, I'm going to tell you what they need. They need insulin at dinner. They need bolus insulin at dinner to get their bedtime down. Now, if we give regular at nighttime, we run the risk of severe hypoglycemia. So let's see what happens. They wake up at 2:43. Why is that? Well, 2 things could be happening, and that is they did get low in the middle of the night. They got nocturnal hypoglycemia. How would we know that? Because patients who get nighttime lows self-report the following. They will say to you, I woke up with really like a headache, or I woke up sweating, or I woke up with, I had bad dreams all night. So these are very common self-reported symptoms of nighttime hypoglycemia. Headache, bad dreams, sweating, hungry. Or what could be happening here is the insulin's running out because they have no what? What kind of insulin are they missing? Exactly. They are missing basal insulin. There's no basal insulin on board to keep their liver in check all night. So this is not thinking like a pancreas. This insulin management strategy is not imitating what the pancreas would do, and that's what's missing. So that's a really good point I'm bringing up. If you ever see a patient's blood sugar out of target range, you think, what would the pancreas be doing right now? Would it be squirting out insulin to cover carbohydrates or hyperglycemia? Or would it be just releasing a gentle insulin to control in between the meal blood sugars to help that fasting blood sugar not be so high? And so, you know, this patient could have got low at night, or they don't have enough basal on board. But let's just take a look at day two. Day two, blood sugar in the morning, 243, bad way to start your day. really we want that blood sugar in the morning to be less than one, you know, right around 130 in the hospital, less than 140 in the hospital, less than 130 in the outpatient side. So I just want to keep moving on to day four. Look what happens on day four. We gave 4 units of regular at bedtime. Look what the patient wakes up with, a 66 in the morning. That's very frightening for people to wake up that low. And that's because that 4 units of regular was just too much, and their blood sugar came down through the night, and we have it reflected in this morning. So if we look at these blood sugars, we know the target for before meal blood sugars is 70 to 140, and the 2-hour post meal blood sugar is less than 180. And so have we reached that goal once in this whole logbook? Have we reached our target? Yes, we reached it the first day at breakfast. That's the only time we were able to reach the target of 70 to 130 before breakfast. But have we reached it any other time? No, we have not. So here's our patient checking their blood sugar 4 times a day, giving insulin 3 and 4 times a day, and never achieving their target blood glucose. So the patient will feel like a failure. They're like, I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to do, and still my blood sugars are above target range. And so you could see the patient might get discouraged. This is another reason sliding scale doesn't work. And I would just say, while I'm on the topic, really avoiding discharging patients on sliding scale to home. It's very complicated for patients to do, especially patients who are living alone, to look at a scale and figure out how much insulin to give. It's a difficult concept to grasp, and many of our patients can't do it safely. And so we need to think of a better plan on discharge, and we'll talk about what different strategies for that. And also thinking about that original slide I showed you, basing the discharge medication plan on their A1C. So maybe sending them home on long-acting insulin plus oral medication. Let's talk a little bit more about basal insulin. Basal insulin, we have the intermediate acting. When it says intermediate, that means just you have to take it twice a day. It only lasts for 12 hours. Or we have the long-acting, Detemir and Glargine, which lasts for about a day. And I've seen a lot of providers splitting up this insulin, these insulins, Detemir and Glargine. It's really not required. These insulins are usually meant to last for 24 hours. And so if we split them up, then that patient has an extra injection. Sometimes it might be necessary, but many times I think what happens is we're not giving enough fast-acting insulin, and that would be a better strategy. And so everybody's different. I would say maybe a few patients genuinely need these insulins split up, but most patients can do it once a day. And I do want to mention that you don't have to give these long-acting insulins at nighttime. They can be given in the morning. Giving it in the morning is okay, especially if the patients are struggling with hypoglycemia at night. It gives them a better safety net. How do we tell how well that basal insulin is working? Looking at the fasting blood sugars. So, and the basal insulin is the turtle. We can use MPH, Levemir, Lantus. MPH lasts for half a day, and the other insulins, the analogs, last for a day. Let's take a look at this patient, because this is another scenario I see quite often, and that is patients on only basal insulin. And this patient, when it says this, it means month 1, month 2, month 3. So in the first month, and this is, we'll talk about the guidelines of care, and the guidelines do say patients new to insulin, we could start them on 10 units of basal insulin at night. It's a very common starting dose. It usually is safe for most patients. If you have very lean patients, we might, you know, start at six or something like that, but 10 is pretty common. So anyways, the provider starts them at 10 units of Lantus, and he's trying to get that fasting blood sugar down. And you can see it's working because each month that fasting blood sugar is dropping. Our target is 70 to 130. We get close to it by month 3. But look where the Lantus is. It went all the way up to 30 units. And so I want to point out something very important. The A1C, though, is still 8.7. So we were getting that morning down. We're feeling good about the morning, but what's happening during the day? And if we ask the patient to check their blood sugar during the day, we can see it's running high. Why? We're not thinking like a pancreas. We are giving the patient basal insulin, which is terrific, but we're not giving them the other side, which is the bolus insulin. And so when you see this happening, there's a term called over-basalization, where patients get a lot of basal insulin. We keep cranking it up, but we're missing where they're hyperglycemic. They're hyperglycemic at meals. We need to add bolus insulin at meals. What can happen with over-basalization is patients start gaining weight and gaining weight and gaining weight because insulin is a growth hormone. So when we use insulin, we need to be very thoughtful about dosing and ratios because patients, we don't want them to gain weight. It makes them more insulin resistant. And patients, if they're on insulin, one of their biggest fears is weight gain. We want to minimize that. And so we'll talk about how to figure out the right ratio of long-acting to short-acting to help minimize that weight gain. Now, I put this in your resources page, so you can actually download this and use it for yourself. And so I don't have prescriptive authority. I don't start patients on insulin, but I am a consultant. So I will suggest insulin doses to providers, and I'm sure many of you are doing that, and maybe some of you are writing prescriptions. But this, even if you don't write prescriptions for insulin, it gives us information. So when patients come in, we can see how off balance are they and where can we make some changes. So here's what it says to do in this handout. This is from Diabetes Care, Managing Hyperglycemia for Patients with Type 2 Diabetes. And you start with bedtime intermediate acting insulin or long-time insulin. So you could do bedtime, or they say here morning also. But look what they say. Start with 10 units. We've been talking about that. 10 units is kind of a very common starting place, or you could do 0.2 units of insulin per kilogram. So you could figure out how much they weigh and do it that way. But 10 units is pretty common. And then look what they say, just what we talked about. Check fasting glucose daily and increase by 2 units every 3 days until fasting levels are in target range, 70 to 130. And so how would this work? You might set up a protocol with your providers and say, hey, you know, is this okay if I do this? Work with the patients and adjust their insulin if their fastings are above target. It could be a protocol that you agree on, or you may just write a note to the provider knowing that this is a very common strategy. Blood sugars are running high in the morning. Can we increase the basal insulin by 2 units? And this is, you know, you gather expertise and comfortableness, and the provider sees you as kind of an extension of what they're doing. It's a team effort. This whole thing relies on a team. And once you become a certified diabetes educator, and some of you already are, this is part of our practice. If you're a dietitian or a pharmacist or a nurse, whatever your profession is, we advise on medication therapy. That's part of what we do, and it's a great role that we have because many patients don't have access to a provider on a regular basis, or maybe they're out of touch with their provider. We can help them get reconnected. This is really important over here, this left-hand box. If hypoglycemia occurs or fasting blood sugar is less than 70, reduce bedtime dose by 4 units or 10%, whichever is greater. Very important. So I had a patient come in to see me. Their morning blood sugar, you know, was running in the 60s and the 70s. They're on 30 units of Lantus at night. I'm going to reduce that by 4 units or 10%. So if they're on 30 units, that's only 3 units. I mean, if they're on, yeah. If they're on 30 units, 10% of that is 3 units. So I'm going to drop it down by 4 units. I'm going to be more aggressive because I don't want that morning blood sugar coming in less than 70. And so I would say in general, you want to pull back on insulin as much as you can because you can always add it back in. But you want to see what is the least amount of insulin this patient needs to get their blood glucose to target. That's such an important point. Let me say it one more time. What is the least amount of insulin this patient needs to get blood sugar to target? We don't want to get into the situation where we're feeding the insulin, where patients are getting lows and eating to cover the lows. They will gain weight. While I'm on this topic, I want to say one more thing, and that is when patients, like, they come in to see you and they're glucose toxic, they've been running 300 and 400, we get them on an insulin regimen and their blood sugars come down to target, you will notice that they will need a decrease in their insulin dosing. And so always ask patients, are you getting low between meals? Are you, you know, getting any hypoglycemia? Because once patients move out of glucose toxicity, their insulin needs decrease. Yes. So I'm always trying to pull back. What's the least amount you need? Because I'm really trying to find this balancing act to prevent hypoglycemia and weight gain, yet get their blood glucose to target. Okay, so what if their fasting blood sugar is on target, but their A1C is more than 7 after 2 to 3 months? Well, we're going to have to look at bolus insulin. And what it says here is really great. If their pre-lunch blood sugar is too high, so lunch is too high, we have to think, when would we add bolus insulin? Let me just say that. If the lunch is too high, when do they need bolus insulin? Exactly. They need it at breakfast. If they have bolus insulin at breakfast, the insulin will cover their carbs at breakfast, and their pre-lunch numbers won't be too high. If their pre-dinner blood sugars are too high, where do we need to add bolus insulin? Pre-dinner is too high. Exactly. We need to add bolus insulin at lunch. And if their bedtime is too high, we need to add bolus insulin at dinner. That's how it rolls. And look at this. It says you can usually begin with 4 units. So you remember how I said most people eat about 45 to 60 grams of carb per meal? So that tells us they would need about 3 to 4 units just to cover food and maybe additional to cover hyperglycemia. Okay, somebody had a question. Let's see what your question was. Oh, somebody was just responding to my questions. Okay, good. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. I'm used to, teaching this live, so it's a little more challenging for me to teach it without seeing you. Let's just talk about combination insulins. Now, I really feel that combination insulins have a big role, especially when people are new to diabetes, they're overwhelmed, they need basal bolus therapy. You can actually use a pre-mixed insulin that offers not only bolus, but basal. And then you only need 1 or 2 shots a day. And so for patients who are glucose toxic, who are kind of overwhelmed with their diabetes, blood sugars are in the 300s to 400s, 70-30 or premixed insulins are a very nice way to get started. Get them out of the 300s to the 200s, and then we can just keep adjusting it. And eventually, they may go to a more sophisticated insulin management, but getting started is really nice to use these pre-mixed insulins. Let me just go over what this means. So if you see an insulin that says 75-25, the 75 means 75% long-acting. This is a Humalog mix. So this is long-acting lispro, MPL. And the other 25 means 25% fast-acting lispro. So the ratio is long-acting to short-acting, 75% long-acting, 25% short-acting. This insulin comes pre-mixed in a pen or a bottle, and you can see it starts working quickly, but it's going to last for half a day. So you get that fast action to cover the meal, and then it lasts up to a half, usually about 12 hours. You need to re-inject. So that's why we give it at breakfast and dinner. The thing about it is you can't really fine-tune therapy. So what I like to do right now is have you look at this patient's logbook. This patient is on a premixed insulin, 10 units of 70-30 before breakfast and dinner. So I always translate that in my head. How much basal is he on? How much bolus? 10 units of 70-30 means he's on 7 units of basal, long-acting, 3 units of bolus, short-acting. So kind of keep that in mind as we look at this pattern. And let me, before I move on, I have a really important question to ask you. It's a poll question. Every question is important. When looking at glucose patterns, what is the issue you want to look at first? What's the issue that demands our attention immediately? All right, most of you have voted. You're looking good here. Okay, let me share your results. Thank you very much for voting. 95% of you said hypoglycemia. You're right on. Hypoglycemia is what we call the limiting factor. You can only get blood sugars down to a certain point, and then past that, you run into this problem with too low. And so let's just take a look. Where do you see this patient struggling the most with their diabetes and their blood sugars? What blood sugars need the most attention? And you can just type it in the questions box right there. Say, what time of day do we need to do something and fix it? What's the most dangerous time of day with this person's log? Exactly. It's lunch. The target for before lunch is 70 to 130. This patient is running 63, 67, 56, and 71. So action is required. If we don't take action, who knows what's going to happen on day five? Maybe they're driving. Maybe they're taking their grandkids somewhere and they pass out at the wheel. This is so critical. I cannot even begin to describe the criticalness of this, because hypoglycemia can impair the person's ability to do what they need to do and can be very dangerous. And so as educators and advocates, we want to help the situation right away. So I would call this an emergent situation. If you can't get a hold of the provider, I would still suggest to that patient you need to adjust your insulin down, or else you could get too low. Or hold your insulin until you talk to your provider, whatever you feel comfortable with. But I want to talk about the 70-30. So we know it's 7 units of long-acting. That 7 units of long-acting insulin affects dinner. Now, dinner target is 70 to 130. We're right on the money at dinner time. We're right where we need to be. The 3 units of the 70-30 is the other 3 units is bolus, or fast-acting insulin. So that is going to affect pre-lunch blood sugars. So pre-lunch are too low. And as a matter of fact, you know, when people have blood sugars that are low, what do they tend to do to get that blood sugar back up? Yeah, they eat to cover it. So she's probably eating more calories than she really wants to because that blood sugar is so low. So what do we do with that 10 units of 70-30? What should we decrease it to? Just think about that for a minute. What would you suggest we decrease it to? Yes, I agree with all of you. Let's get it down to at least 8 units. So this is something we can do very easily. Say to the patient, you know, I really am worried about your lunch blood sugar numbers. They're below target. They're less than 70. And I want to help work with you to get your blood sugars to more than 70 at lunchtime. Let me talk to the provider, but I think we should reduce your 70-30 to 8 units before breakfast. If that patient, I want to be honest with you, what if they're frail, elderly, they live alone, they have a history of hypoglycemia? I'm going to go down even more to 7 or 6 units. We always want to look at safety first. That's so, so important. So let's decrease this 70-30. Let's just go to, let's say, 8 units for right now. And let's look at any other blood sugars that we see. So once we fix hypoglycemia, we are now going to fix hyperglycemia. What other time of day is standing out to you as problematic? Absolutely, bedtime. Our goal for nighttime is less than 180. This patient is never making it to less than 180. But are they close? Yes, they are close. They're only about 20 points over target. So they're just a little bit above target. So I don't want to increase the 70-30 insulin, because if I do, I'll get this number down, but the basal part of the long-acting insulin in that 70-30 might make this morning blood sugar go too low. I like 90s, low 100s. That's a great place to wake up. Once a patient starts waking up in the 70s, I'm a lot more nervous because they could wake up in the 60 very easily. So I like these numbers. I don't want to bring them down any lower. And so, besides adjusting the insulin up, what else could we do to get these numbers target? Well, there's 2 important things we're going to suggest to these patients, and this is what I do all the time. I tell them, you know what, I don't want to increase your insulin if we can avoid it, because we know that insulin is associated with weight gain. We want to get to the right insulin dose so we minimize weight gain. And would you be willing, I always start with this, this is you, when you ever hear me say this to somebody, would you be willing, you know, I'm going to ask them for something. Would you be willing to walk for 15 minutes after dinner? And I'll just pause. And then I'll say, you know what? That 15-minute walk is like 2 units of insulin. Really? Yeah, it is. Exercise is a therapeutic intervention. Exercise lowers blood sugars. What if they can't exercise? They say, man, I can't walk. I got bad knees, or I have some other problem. Can you sit in your chair and move? People can do amazing things in a chair as far as exercise. And so we're going to negotiate that. The other thing we could say is, let's take a look at your carbohydrates at dinner. And let's see if we could cut back a little bit on carbohydrate. Would that be something you'd like to discuss? I'm always going to ask permission before behavior change counseling. I'm going to ask permission because it's a sensitive area to talk about food and cutting back on carbs. So I want to gather the patient's motivations. We want to move forward together. So I would say, you know what, I'm kind of concerned you're above target at bedtime. There's two strategies. We could try exercising, and if they say, no, it's not going to work, I'm like, okay, would you be willing to consider looking at your carbohydrates and maybe cutting back on carbs a little bit to get your blood sugar to target? So those are some of the negotiations that are going to take place with patients. And that, you know what, we get really good at that. Diabetes educators have a special skill set on helping patients succeed at behavior change. And generally, we have more time than providers because part of the diabetes education program is a one-hour individual assessment, and then we get to see patients for 9 hours of group time. So we have plenty of opportunity to help with behavior change and encourage patients and support their journey toward making different choices. We can't do it for them, but we can certainly tap into their motivation and help them work toward that. And if anybody here is planning on taking the CDE exam, the philosophical underpinning is just what I said, is that helping patients make behavior changes or move toward changing their behavior is about what the exam is all about. We know we can't make people do things, but how do we provide an environment and resources and support to help them succeed? That's the real underpinnings. And then we want to help and encourage our patients when they're succeeding and help them find strategies around barriers. So this just looks at pattern management. We've talked about this already. We look at low blood sugar first, and then we address high blood sugar. Let's look at this patient. He's type 2. He's on Amaryl. And we haven't talked about medications yet, but we will in our next class, and Amaryl, well, the class after, actually. Amaryl is a sulfonylurea, and it works for 24 hours to lower blood sugar. And then he's on 10 units of Lantus and then at night. So the first thing we're going to do when we identify patterns is look for what kind of blood sugars? Low. So the low blood sugar, it's just jumping out at us, dinner time. There was a 43 on day 4, very scary. So this patient is at risk for severe hypoglycemia. Once your blood sugar gets around 40, you get what we call neuroglycopenic, and you have a hard time focusing, concentrating, thinking that you need to eat something. People might even get combative. So this is a huge danger signal to me. And what I want to ask you all is, what do you think is causing the low blood sugar? Is it the Amaryl or the Lantus? Which of these is a guilty party? Which of these would you call the provider and say, ask if we could reduce? Well, I'll tell you, you're right. It's not the Lantus. The Lantus we give at night, and it lasts for about 24 hours. So by dinner time, it's really waxing and waning. It doesn't have as much steam. And It's not the Lantus, because we just know the pharmacokinetics of Lantus tell us that it's probably at its weakest point right then. So it's not the Lantus at fault. It's the Amaryl. Amaryl is a sulfonylurea, and it's very potent at helping to lower blood sugars. So we know, that the Amaryl is what's causing the low. So what are we going to do when we call the provider? We're going to say, hey, doctor, thank you for your time. I'm very concerned this patient's blood sugars are running below 70 at dinner time, and I'm wondering if we could decrease the Amaryl. It's at 4 milligrams. Could we cut it in half? Or you may just say, if you're not that comfortable, just say, provider, I wanted to, doctor, provider, whatever you call them, I want to bring this to your attention that the dinner blood sugars are running less than 70. The patient's on Amaryl and Lantus, and I want, what could we do to help get this blood sugar to target? That's another way of phrasing it. And so whatever we do, we have to take action immediately. This patient's at high risk. So I may say to this patient, if I don't get a hold of the provider, don't take your Amaryl in the morning till you talk to your provider and let them know what your blood sugars are. Or if I have a good relationship with the provider, I might just go ahead and cut the dose in half and write a note and fax it to the provider. And usually if I have I've established that rapport with them, that works out really good. Okay, let me just take a look. So we fixed the dinner blood sugar. And I'm going to tell you the truth. I think nighttime is high because this patient's running so low at dinner, they're really compensating and eating a lot of food at dinner time. And that's why they're running high. So I wouldn't change anything at the bedtime until we get this fixed, the dinner time fixed. And then looking at breakfast, again, I would just reduce the Amaryl, see what happens. But we certainly are getting information that this patient probably needs to increase the Lantus at bedtime to get the morning blood sugars to target of less than 130. But that would be a secondary step we do after we fix the low blood sugar. Okay, I'm going to keep moving on. So basal bolus, what adjustments should we make? So this patient, when I say basal bolus, is on a combination of bolus, H stands for Humalog, and basal as Detemir. They're on basal bolus, and they're taking their bolus insulin 3 times a day, their long-acting insulin 1 a day. Just take a look at patterns and see, A, what pattern needs to be fixed first? What time of day? I should start there. You're right. Sometimes my pointer gets carried away, so I'm sorry about that. Computers really do have a mind of their own. So here we go. The breakfast is too low. Our target is at breakfast 70 to 130. We need to take action to prevent future hypoglycemia. I see this a lot in the hospital setting where patients are on Lantus at night and they wake up with low blood sugars and the staff is treating the low, but what you really need to do is reduce the basal insulin, reduce the nighttime Lantus, or in this case, Detemir. Reduce the nighttime basal insulin because basal insulin is what affects morning blood sugar, and this morning blood sugars are too low. So remember the rule of thumb. We said reduce it by 10% or 4 units, whatever is greater. So 10% of 22 is 2.2 units. That's not going to do much for us. We're going to reduce this Detemir to 18. Reduce it by 4 units. And by doing that, we'll get that breakfast blood sugar up to where it needs to be. Okay, so we're bringing the Detemir down to 18. We've got the morning blood sugar to a better place. And then we have the next thing we're going to deal with here is dinner time. Dinner time is definitely above target. The target's 70 to 130 before dinner. He's never reaching it. So where's the culprit here? Well, every day at lunch, he takes 5 units of Humalog. And at dinner, he takes 8 units. And at breakfast, he takes 7 units of Humalog. Where did that come from? So every day, he never adjusts his insulin. He never modifies it. It's always the same, regardless of what his blood sugars are. Now, if you see patients like that, it's a really good sign that they have not been taught how to adjust their insulin. They're taking it, 3 and 4 times a day. Look at all the work this person is doing, seriously. They're checking their blood sugar 4 times a day. They're taking their insulin 4 times a day. They're keeping a logbook. They haven't missed a beat. They're doing everything right. For doing everything right, they should have great blood sugar numbers, and yet we're not there. So what I'd like to share with you, and this is a real patient. I asked the patient, where'd you get this insulin dose? 7 of Humalog at breakfast, 5 at lunch, 8 at dinner, and 22 of Detemir. And he said, well, I had a doctor about 10 years ago who started me on this, and I just kind of adjusted it myself. Has anybody heard of patients doing that? Sure, they do it all the time. They're put on insulin. They don't want to go back to the doctors. They just start adjusting their insulin themselves. But they get into trouble because they don't know how to adjust it to get to target. Some patients do, and some patients really struggle with it. So what I would like to share with you right now is an insulin dosing strategy. So I showed you one strategy, type 2 and hyperglycemia, how you start with 10 units of basal, then you add bolus throughout the day. This is a different strategy. This is based on patient's body weight, and it's called the 50-50 rule, And it's used a lot in the hospital setting. Providers are familiar with it. And it's really just basing insulin on body weight. And so here's an example. You take the patient's body weight in kilograms and you times it times 0.5. So if I weighed 50 kilograms, I'd say 50 times 0.5 is 25. So I need about 25 units of insulin per day based on my body weight. But you don't just take that in one injection. You have to, you know, split it up throughout the day. So as I've been talking about, 50% of it should be basal and the other 50% bolus. So half of 25 is about 13, and so I would need 13 units of basal once a day, and then what's I need as far as bolus is the other half, 12 units. So I need 12 units of fast acting that I'm going to divide up between my three meals. So 12 divided by three meals is about 4 units per meal. Is this sounding familiar? Remember that the algorithm I showed you, it said 10 units at night and then about 4 units every meal. We came up with the same numbers using a body weight formula. So it's kind of a getting started target. And if I have patients come in to see me and their blood sugars are out of whack, I'll use this formula to figure out what should their insulin dose be. So what I'd like to do right now is have you all just spend 30 seconds or so filling in the blanks here. If a patient comes in to see you and they weigh 60 kilograms, what would their insulin dose need to be? So figure out the total and then basal and what their bolus would need to be. Okay. Let me go ahead and do this with you. So what I would really like you to do is when you meet with your patients, use this formula if you have patients on insulin and just see what are they on and how close or far away are they from this formula. And that will help you kind of make some changes in their insulin therapy or suggestions to the provider. So it gives us some structure and a framework to look at insulin therapy from. So let's take like 60 kilograms times 0.5, they need 30 units of insulin a day. Half of that is their basal dose, 15 units, and the other half is their bolus dose. So we give that 15 units, maybe we give it in the morning or give it at night. It could be glargine. If they're on MPH or Detomir, we might give it twice a day. And then the bolus dose, we have the other 15 units. We divide that by three meals, so 5 units each meal. Well, so let's take a look at that guy that we saw earlier where he was just taking, you know, that standard amount of insulin, 5, 8, 7, whatever he was on. And let's apply the 50-50 rule to him. He weighs 80 kilograms. So let's just do the math together. So he needs 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram. So 80 times 0.5 is 40 units a day, 40. Half of that is basal. So that would be 20 units of basal. And the other half is bolus, and the bolus is 20 units, but we divide that into three meals. So 20 into 3, or 3, yeah, 20 divided by 3, you can't do that. So you say 7 and 7, which is 14 plus a 6 to get to 20. So let's take a look. This patient is now on 6 units of Humalog every breakfast, 7 units at lunch, 7 units at dinner, and 20 of Detomir. Same patient, we just reassigned insulin dosing based on this formula. How do his blood sugars look now? Aren't they a lot better? I mean, truly, this is what I see all the time. Just by tweaking things a little bit, we can really improve outcomes for our patients. And that's where, as educators and advocates, we can really make a big difference in patients' quality of life. Just spending the time looking at their logbooks, making these small adjustments, can make a big difference as far as outcomes and just their overall sense of mastery of their diabetes. So we do have a few, you know, blips on the radar screen, and that is this 208. So when I'm looking at logbooks, I want to look for patterns. That is not a pattern. That's just one elevated blood sugar. One elevated blood sugar isn't a pattern. And as a matter of fact, I tell my patients, let's do the 80-20 rule. 80% of the time, we get blood sugars to target. 20%, we have a little wiggle room, as long as our A1C is where it needs to be. And so this, I'm thinking, is a, I see cake here. I see a party at work and they serve cake or some sweets and he ate them and he ran a little bit high at dinner time. And so this is what I would call a teaching opportunity. When we see those numbers that don't quite match the pattern, I'm going to say, hey, what do you think happened here? And do some investigation with the patient. And most of the time they come up with the best solutions to that. Because who knows their diabetes better than them? Nobody. Now, I'm sure many of you are also looking at these numbers at breakfast. So look at day one, day two, day three, day four. Huh. By day four, that morning blood sugar is less than 70. And this is what I was talking about as people move out of glucose toxicity, as they get their blood sugars closer to target, they need less insulin. And so when we look at patterns, we want to look at not just meal times, but over time, what happens to their blood sugars. And this patient definitely at breakfast, by day five, he's going to be 65. We can already predict that's going to be lower. So what do we need to do to fix that? Right, absolutely. We need to decrease the nighttime basal, known as Dedimer. And we said 10% or 4 units, whatever is more. And 10% of 20 is 2. So it's not 2. We got to decrease it by 4 units. Let's bring it down to 16. That feels really good to me. Get it down to 16, get those morning blood sugars, closer to the 80 and 90 range. And always looking to give patients the least amount of insulin they need to get blood sugars to goal. And as we get more familiar and comfortable with this patient, we're going to start integrating carbohydrate counting. We're going to start integrating hyperglycemia management. If you're high by 50 points above your target, add 1 unit. If you're going to eat extra carbs, add a unit. If you're going to eat less carbs, decrease a unit. So this is just our starting number, and then we can add from there and help our patients really understand. Let's do one last poll before we kind of wrap up. Let's see what I have here. When we're teaching about insulin injection, which of the following is a teaching strategy we want to include in our discussion about insulin and being safe with it? Okay, most of you have voted. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Thank you so much for voting, everybody, and staying with us. So some of you chose this first, and actually a patient taught this to me. It was so funny. He goes, I tie. And I go, what does tie stand for? He goes, I test, inject, and eat. I love that. It's really easy to remember. And I also thought you could say pie, poke, inject, and eat. So whatever works for you, whatever mnemonic, but it really helps our patients remember that there's an order. You need to test, inject, and eat. So that is one of the right answers. What about abdomen is preferred injection site? Another right answer. Use sharps container to dispose of needles and sharps. Very important. We teach our patients proper disposal. Always have treatment for a hypo available, and you all are right. It's all of the above. 90% of you chose that. We need to tell our patients all of these things when it comes to insulin and insulin safety. Very, very important teaching keys for our patients. Thank you, everyone. And so here's they are just listed out on the slide, the different things we want to teach our patients about insulin and tossing after 28 days because insulin can lose its potency, how to dispose of it, stay 1 inch away from the previous site, and really take time to watch your patients withdraw and inject insulin. Make sure they're getting into subcutaneous tissue, not muscle, and make sure that they can see to draw up their insulin properly. Here's some sharps disposal information. There's a 1-800 phone number that's national. You can call and find out where can patients take sharps. There's also this really cool BD safe clip that patients can put the needle into that clip. It's $5 for the clip. It clips the needle and it holds 2 years supply of needle. And then all you have to do, you can throw the barrel of the needle in the trash, and that little clipper is the only hazardous waste involved. And so we want to really make sure our patients know how to dispose of these safely and securely. I want to thank you so much for joining us. We've covered a lot of information today. We talked about inpatient management. We talked about basal bolus insulin. We've talked about, how to help patients take insulin safely and being an advocate for them and partnering with the medical team. And next week, we'll be talking about looking at a lower extremity assessment, and also we'll be talking about medical nutrition therapy. So thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to stop the recording, but I welcome you to stay and I can answer any of your questions. Thank you so much. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.